Council, you ready to proceed?
Chief Justice Steele, Justice Holland, Justice Jacobs, can't talk, Justice Jacobs, good morning. On a personal note, during the course of my brief remarks, I expect them to be brief, hopefully, my collar may fly open. And if it does, I may not be aware of it, and I don't want you all thinking poor Joe doesn't know his collar's open. I send my suits and shirts to a Chinese cleaner who for 12 years, or which for 12 years, has been excellent. Since Christmas, all of my shirt collars have shrunken, and the three suits I've sent over have shrunk. So there's a defect over there. I'm going to get a new cleaner, so that may happen. I've had a problem.
You don't think that has anything to do with what you ate over the holidays?
You always have a keen analytical ability that's known, yes. I think so.
We get your subtle points.
I understand. What you have here is either, and I'm just pointing at this, a tsunami where our argument has overwhelmed the state and they recognize it, or where, much like a southern cotton farmer who in the summertime uses a fly swatter to swat away a pesky fly, there's not much more that's necessary than one swat, and you'll decide that. By way of background, and this is obviously it's not necessary for the analytical process that you have to endure or affect, and it's I didn't put it in here because I didn't think it was necessary, but it might just be helpful so you have a context. The young lady in question and the victim in this particular case had gone to school together in grade school. There was an allegation that he had sexually molested her and was expelled. Years go by, and they encounter each other a couple of weeks before this particular incident. They smoke marijuana together, and he offers to sell her marijuana. And she decides to get her vengeance by setting him up and invites him over to the school to smoke marijuana together, tells her brother about it, and her brother and his two friends come over to take away the marijuana instead of paying for it. And that is the background of why these two people were in an elementary school area. We're now here about $381.28, and certainly you didn't invite us down here to talk about that. And as I see it, the initial analytical inquiry is whether or not the Sixth Amendment rights, the panoply of confrontation rights, apply to a restitution hearing, which is another way of saying is a restitution hearing part of a criminal prosecution. Although in Jenkins, which I footnote, I say that my advancement of the proposition that the Sixth Amendment applies to a restitution hearing is suspect because it clearly does not to a violation of probation hearing. On the other hand, there is an argument that can be made that the confrontation rights begin at the moment the first witness is called. They certainly don't end at the moment of trial. Logically, they end when the sentencing is complete because that is the end of the criminal prosecution. Certainly, a violation of probation is an extension of a criminal prosecution, but it is a different animal. On the other hand, how can one argue that the imposition of sentence, whether it's incarceration, fines, or costs, is not still part of the criminal prosecution? So I advance the proposition that this court can easily distinguish Jenkins because of the continuum between the beginning, the onset of trial, and the calling of the witness, and the end of the prosecution, the moment that sentence is pronounced.
And how does that work if we have a situation where the judge sentences and says part of the sentence is to make restitution, and then there's a dispute about the amount of restitution and the actual restitution inquiry takes place after the sentencing? Does that make any difference to your argument?
No. Final judgment occurs when the final order is signed. And if there's things that are left open, then it's not finalized. Therefore, the criminal prosecution lives.
That's certainly a valid concept on the civil litigation side. But does that apply on the criminal side?
I believe it does, because otherwise, if you don't do that, I'll back into it the other way. If you don't say logically, legally, constitutionally, it terminates upon final sentence imposition, well, when does it? Does it stop at the moment the jury returns a verdict? That's not logical, because the most important element, or a most important element, of the criminal prosecution is the sentence.
Well, Mr. Hurley, many instances, judges sentence based on the contents of a pre-sentence investigation, which is a compilation of information by a pre-sentence officer, and there's not a factual hearing about, with an opportunity to cross-examine the pre-sentence officer or the sources of his information. Is that only because, in your view, defense counsel doesn't demand it? And if they did, the Constitution would require there be a hearing and cross-examination of all the sources of the information? that are contained in the pre-sentence investigation, and that therefore, potentially, but for waiver, there would be a right to confront all of those witnesses that supplied that information?
I often tell people I'm never smart enough to be a judge, and a question like that proves it. In law school, they say, don't say checkmate, but I think checkmate. No, absolutely not. There is certainly no right to have confrontation rights as far as the pre-sentence report goes, and that's a due process situation, clearly. And I hadn't thought of that, and I don't have an answer for that.
Well, let's assume that since a trial judge is required by law to order restitution when restitution is an issue, and that is, Justice Jacobs questioned you, that there has to be a determination of what's fair, what's accurate amount of restitution. In this case, where the questions that you object to were asked, why are they any different than any other evidentiary ruling made during the course of trial or during the course of any other proceeding where a witness is on the stand, you have a right to confront them, you ask the witness questions, yet there's an objection to the question on the grounds it's not relevant, or there's an objection on another basis, and the trial judge rules, I'm not going to get into that stuff, which we could loosely interpret to be it's not relevant. Why do we address it under any circumstance other than abuse of discretion?
Because I take the position it's a constitutional matter rather than a abuse of discretion evidentiary matter.
Well, but distinguish it for me. When then would any other ruling, you can't ask that question, not be a deprivation of the right to confront the witness and simply be an evidentiary ruling? What's the distinction?
When you're dealing with a standard of relevance only versus a standard of constitutional dimension, there are many questions that are asked that are on a 402, 403, 404 basis that do not implicate whatsoever confrontation. So,
I'm not going to allow you to ask that question because whether or not that person smoked marijuana or doesn't go to the issue of what the material that was lost was worth or how much cash was in his pocket at the time of the confrontation?
It does, but it is superseded under the umbrella of a constitutional deprivation when you get into confrontation rights.
So when we're confrontation, I thought, was the right of the accused, of the defendant, to cross-examine whoever is testifying or giving evidence against the accused.
Agreed.
We certainly don't have a problem in that regard. That is, there was a right of confrontation in the sense of there being a cross-examination. What you're saying is that the rules of evidence somehow don't apply in some vaguely defined subcategory of the questions that can be asked at cross-examination. That is, we're not just into the ordinary rules of evidence. We now have the trial judge being required to engage in a double layer of analysis. A, does this question pass muster under the rules of evidence, and B, if it doesn't, is it nonetheless required because it's invokes a confrontation right?
I agree with you. That's my argument. Let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. The point that I make is the moment that a judge challenges the admissibility of evidence and says, what's the relevance of this? And somebody argues relevance, we're talking abuse of discretion. The moment the person says bias, we then get implications of the Sixth Amendment confrontation, and there's a different standard that this court must determine. A de novo applies rather than abuse of discretion.
Your argument, as I understand it, based on your citation to Weber and our other cases, is once you're cross-examining, you have almost an unbridled right to pursue bias, in that if you're going to exclude cross-examination based on bias, that you can only do that in very limited circumstances.
That is a position that I would take. And
now, in this particular case, the judge didn't let you explore bias based on the consumption of marijuana, but the judge was aware of this prior history between the two people. Wasn't that before the judge?
It was. If you're saying it was before the judge because of the proffer I made, he said that he would not allow that, so it was not. In terms of the pre-sentence investigation, I simply don't remember what was reported, whether or not – oh, I know what wasn't reported. The threats and all that was not reported in the pre-sentence investigation. They throw my urine on you, drown in my urine. That material was not in the pre-sentence investigation. I don't know that he was aware of that.
No, about the prior sexual assault, did the judge know about that?
I don't know that he did, and I don't know that he didn't, but I wasn't going to go there because it was too distant.
Right. So in this, but in this case, it's all part of the motivation to lie. She set the fellow up, as you recited the facts to us, giving us the background. And as I understand it, maybe I don't understand it. She are you saying she lied and gave the wrong amount of money because she was under the influence of marijuana, or she gave the wrong amount of money because she had this prior grudge?
It's not she. It's he, the victim.
Right, he. Right.
I'm saying that with regard to the issue of being under the influence of drugs, he said it's $200. If he's high on marijuana, who knows, it wasn't 198, 158.
But it has nothing to do with the prior incident involving his sister.
No. I just gave you that as background.
So you want to show, just as a confession would be involuntary if you're under the influence of drugs, this testimony about what was taken should be suspect because he was under the influence of drugs.
Only as to the amount of currency. A person's going to know if their cell phone's taken. I can't say you're high on marijuana, you're going to mistake your cell phone or your sneakers. But with regard to that undocumented judge, I had $200 in my pocket. Not 173, not 174. If he's high as a kite on marijuana, the judge can consider that without any further documentation.
Well, let's assume that the trial judge would have been prudent in allowing you to ask the question, because the follow-up would have been, so what? You were smoking marijuana. Did you make an offer of proof that a person of that size, that experience of smoking marijuana, would have been at the certain threshold that they wouldn't, it would have been so impaired that they couldn't remember the sum of $200 as opposed to 190 or 250?
I could not have made that proffer, and in fact, I anticipated he would deny that he was smoking marijuana, and at which time I would have called my client to indicate they were passing it back and forth and impeached his credibility in that fashion. I didn't expect him to say, yeah, as a matter of fact, I was smoking marijuana. But no, I was not prepared to do that. Even if, for the purposes of the argument, I am incorrect in my assessment that the Sixth Amendment still applies at that stage, clearly, I argue, due process does apply at a restitution hearing, and even though the safeguards of cross-examination that are permitted under due process are not as extensive, don't have the teeth in them that the Sixth Amendment does, nonetheless, this basic situation of I'm going to cut you up, throw you in a barrel, drown you in my urine is something that even under the most rudimentary concepts of due process is pertinent and should have been allowed.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
If it please the court, the state's position on this is that at the restitution hearing, which, by the way, Ms. Franco had pleaded guilty already to reduced charges of theft misdemeanor and third-degree conspiracy. She was sentenced to probation at the time of the initial sentencing. Restitution was ordered in an amount to be determined by the Department of Probation and Parole, which is normally the case. There was a dispute about that, which is how months later this restitution hearing came to be. Now, Judge Hurley at the restitution hearing is there for a very specific purpose, and that's to determine the amount of restitution. Judge Hurley not only is the guardian of the evidence, but he's also sitting here as trier of fact. And Mr. Hurley, in his detailed proffer, had made Judge Hurley very well aware of what he wants to show. And Judge Hurley, as trier of fact, has said to Mr. Hurley, let's not waste our time because I'm just not going to consider that because I don't think it's relevant.
Well,
basically,
tell us what, at a restitution hearing, what bias or anything like bias is relevant?
Well, certainly if the trier of fact, which is going to be the judge, feels that the victim, because of some bias towards the defendant, is simply going to get on the witness stand and lie, the judge could, in the judge's discretion, and as trier of fact, consider that. Judge Hurley,
the question is he compelled to consider it?
He's not compelled. I mean, the judge is the trier of fact. What the judge wants to consider or not. Because if the judge wants to, as the trier of fact and the sole and exclusive judge of the credibility of witnesses, the judge can consider bias and go down that route. Or
well, let's say hypothetically, by analogy to this case, Mr. Hurley said, I'd like to demonstrate why this witness is biased. And the judge said, I don't want to hear about bias. I just want to know how much money was taken. So I'm not hearing about bias. Just let's move on to how much money is at risk. Would that be a ruling that could be sustained on appeal?
I believe so. I mean, if the judge feels that at this particular hearing, bias simply is not going to play any role and doesn't want to waste everybody's time listening to evidence that the judge is not going to consider to begin with, just wants a dollar amount, which was the case here. But again, in this case, Judge Hurley was certainly aware through Mr. Hurley's detailed proffers of the relationship, and as far as bias goes, of course, obviously a victim of a crime of violence is going to be biased against the defendants who perpetrated that that crime.
Well, but what Mr. Hurley is trying to talk about is a general proposition. We know the victim is going to be biased, but suppose instead of $200, the victim said, I had $3,000. I just cashed an insurance check or something like that. And the defense said, well, I want to show bias on why this person is making up the $3,000. And the judge said, well, I'm not hearing about bias. His number's $3,000.
Well, again, certainly I can only repeat that as the trier of fact, that is up to the trier of fact. Now, I suppose on appeal at some point the court could say, well, there was an abuse of discretion in not considering all relevant factors. And perhaps I'm just being blindsided here by the dollar amount, $3,000 as opposed to $200, which was not documented, but at least the victim had some idea why he had $200 on his person. He had just cashed his paycheck and had the money for a specific $200, even for a specific purpose. But
Mr. Donovan,
again, every case is going to, I suppose, turn on its own facts.
Mr. Donovan, yes. Was there any documentary evidence to support the testimony as to the items that were taken?
The cell phone that was taken was recovered by the police. However, the police kept it as evidence, which is why the victim had to get a new one, and he brought a receipt in, which is why the restitution amount is $191.28 or $391.28. So he had a receipt for that. And the $200 was the...
That was his recollection.
That was his recollection of how much he had in his pocket. And he also asked for $30 for the sneakers, which the judge discounted.
Do you see any distinction between the ruling that I'm not going to listen to evidence about the fact they were smoking marijuana because, A, they pled guilty to the charges and I'm not getting into any of this other stuff, on the basis that there wouldn't be any follow-up to show that the smoking of marijuana would or could have influenced this person into not recalling accurately the amount of cash that he had?
No, I don't.
As opposed to the argument that I want to show why this witness has a motivation to lie and exaggerate the amount of cash because of bias toward the defendant. Is there a distinction between the two rulings?
Oh, I would certainly say so. I mean, bias is certainly one thing. Smoking marijuana, therefore, I don't have a... He is not a good fact witness, basically, is what one is saying. He's not lying. He's not attempting to deceive, but because of some disability, in this case intoxication through marijuana, he's simply not a reliable fact witness. Now, when you go over to the other side and say the witness is biased, what you're saying is that the witness is deliberately lying basically, is perjuring himself. And so those are certainly two different animals entirely. The witness is an unreliable fact witness. The witness lacks credibility. I'm not quite sure where Mr. Hurley was going on this one. My suspicion is he was going on the witnesses not being credible because of the prior relationship between the two and because of, not sure what the marijuana has to do with this, but because of bad blood between the two in the past, rather than because they were smoking marijuana, victim couldn't recall the dollar amount. If the purpose of getting in that testimony was simply to paint the victim as a bad person, well, that's neither here nor there at this point. I don't think anybody really believed anything else. He was there behind the school to meet this girl for the purpose of, and I think this was out in the open, the purpose of smoking some marijuana and perhaps having a good time when he was attacked by her brother and his compadres, who Mr. Hurley left this point out. They attacked him with a basketball. They did. They knocked him down with a basketball. And,
As I understood, the bias argument was on the basis that Pyle called Franco and threatened her after the incident. It didn't have to do with the past association.
And the past bad blood and of course, the incident itself. And then, again, all these people knew each other.
The telephone message in which he made threats in a very graphic way.
Yes.
Now, wouldn't that fact indicate, or at least be probative of a motive to lie?
Well, he
dislikes this victim, this defendant, so much that... he'll get back at her.
It could be.
And if it could be, then why was it not error for the judge not to consider that?
Well, the judge, again, as the trier of fact, the judge has this almost unbridled discretion in deciding what is credible and what is not. And it's basically, is the victim and... The only issue here is the $200. Is the victim lying when he says that he's out $200 or not? And that is strictly a credibility issue.
The judge can avoid even addressing the credibility issue if the judge doesn't allow the evidence that would give put credibility in issue in the record in the first place.
Actually, through the proffer of Mr. Hurley, it is on the record, and Judge Hurley was well aware of the evidence, but simply refused to consider it, didn't think it was particularly relevant in this case. Now, certainly if this had been a trial and Judge Hurley was keeping the evidence from the trier of fact, that would be a different situation altogether. But where Judge Hurley is, in fact, the trier of fact, and as such decides that credibility is simply not an issue regarding this $200, and he doesn't want to get into the bad blood between the victim and the defendant Franco and the rest of them, and smoking marijuana and all this other stuff, he just wants a dollar amount. And he'll
accept the
$200.
Unfortunately, that's what's given rise to the appeal, isn't it? The fact that he didn't allow it in the record. Had he allowed the question and the answer and then analyzed it the way you've suggested and say, well, on credibility, it has no effect. I don't think it constitutes bias. I'm rejecting it. And I'm believing the testimony of the witness, we wouldn't be here.
No, well, this is certainly true. I agree. But again, my position is that in essence, that's what Judge Early he did in making what seems to be an evidentiary ruling. He's telling Mr. Hurley, please, don't go into that. I know where you're going. I know what the evidence is going to be, but I am not going to consider it because I don't think it's particularly pertinent to the job I have to do here, which is determine this dollar amount. And I have a receipt for the cell phone, and quite frankly, I find the victim's testimony regarding the amount of money he had in his pocket credible.
Did Mr. Hurley make an offer of proof regarding the telephone message?
All of that, I believe. Yes, I believe all of that is in the...
There was a proffer.
Yes, it was part of the proffer. Mr. Hurley made a number of very extensive proffers. I don't think he left anything out.
But your argument seems to, as using your words, to be influenced by the amount in question. And during his direct testimony, the victim says $200. And if the victim had said $10,000, perhaps Judge Hurley, he would have allowed all of this questions, all of these questions about bias or credibility, because he might have had more concerns about $10,000. But having decided $200 was a number that had some basis in fact, he excluded what Mr. Hurley wanted to do. And Mr. Hurley's point is, $200 may not be important to you. $200 is important to my client. And if I have a right to cross-examine on $10,000, I have the same right to cross-examine on $200. What do we do with that argument?
Well, I think Your Honor hit on it when Your Honor said that the $200 is, in effect, a reasonable amount to have on your person. But if suddenly you were to say, oh, I had $10,000 in cash on my person, well, that certainly alarm bells would be going off. That in and of itself does not appear very credible. But the fact that the victim had that particular amount and was able to say why he had it with him. He had just cashed his paycheck and had the exact amount of $200, I forget, for auto repair or give it to his sister or something. But he knew that he had counted out $200 and put it in his pocket. So he had some reason. It was a reasonable amount to give. And he proffered some reason why he would know it to the dollar. If he had, about $10,000, that would certainly be cause for asking questions about the credibility.
So then it would go back to a discretionary ruling.
Yeah.
Where the judge is saying, look, the guy said $200, and we're not going to spend the rest of the afternoon here talking about reasons he might have had to lie, because the $200 makes sense based on his direct testimony.
Yes, his direct testimony does not indicate any reason to suspect that it's anything but accurate. And cross-examination on all of this other matter really isn't going to change my opinion of that. I think it's a reasonable amount for him to be carrying around, and he explained why he had it on his person. And you can paint him with as dark a brush as you want, and it's just not going to change my mind.
So basically, what you're asking us to do is to conclude that it's probable that 18 out of 19 Superior Court judges would have said, no matter how biased Mr. Hurley can paint this guy, $200 is not an unreasonable amount of money for somebody to have under the circumstances. So we'll let it in. We'll consider it, and we'll have a one-liner in the record that says, I've considered the argument of bias, and I reject it for the following logical reason. $200 is a reasonable amount. There's nothing I've heard about bias that changes my mind about that. But the one out of the 19 who says, I'm not going to hear it at all because it would be a waste of my time, we should just say that's fine, because the two analyses under our system are basically the same, and we shouldn't worry that there are trial judges who are rejecting evidence that otherwise should come in and be analyzed by them purely on a waste of time basis. That's what you want us to hold?
Well, no, I think Judge Hurley, in rejecting Mr. Hurley's detailed proffer, made basically that decision. I don't think there's anything mysterious
So the proffer is as good as cross-examination of a witness that elicits the same
in this context at this hearing. Mr. Hurley, Dale Proffer, specifically told the judge what he intended to prove at the best.
But Mr. Hurley's argument is that due process says there is magic in cross-examination, and if I could extract from the witness the evidence that supports his bias, I might well be able to show the judge that he's exaggerating when he says $200. A sterile proffer, on the other hand, of what I might be able to elicit might not convince the judge. That's why we have an Anglo-American adversary system, to have an experienced lawyer cross-examine a witness and get from the witness's own mouth damning testimony that will cast a taint on his credibility. But I never had a shot at that here, because the trial judge just decided for himself based on the proffer. And you're suggesting to us that's fine, given the fact this is simply a restitution hearing, and the amount is only $200. Is that about fairly sum it up?
As prior fact, yes, that was Judge Hurley's petition. He did not want to hear it in these circumstances. Under the circumstances of this case, he made a decision during the hearing that he was not going to consider any of this evidence.
On that basis, we could use the European civil law system and just have the lawyers summarize the potential testimony of all the witnesses, submit it to the judge, and the judge could say, I don't have the time to hear all these witnesses testify. I'll just look at the proffers from each side, and I'll decide which witnesses seem, on an analysis of their proffer, to be more logical and credible than the others. Because I just don't have the time to deal with this cross-examination nonsense. Right?
Well, in a restitution hearing, I suppose, since this is not a trial, and we're not dealing with matters of guilt or innocence, as long as due process, fundamental fairness is followed, and which is the burden that Mr. Hurley has to show, that Judge Hurley's decision-making at this particular hearing denied him a fundamental fairness. It's a safe position that it did not. No, all the full panoply of protections that apply to a criminal trial do not apply to a hearing of this type. Again, it is the state's position that Judge Hurley made the decision during cross-examination, and it was Judge Hurley who made the objection, as it were, saying that he didn't want to hear this other stuff, that he wanted to get to the that he didn't consider it relevant, and was not going to consider it in determining the dollar amount of the cash that was taken from the victim. And it's the state's position that that was a, under the circumstances of this case, that was not an abuse of discretion, as the trial judge was sitting as the trier of fact in this hearing.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Four points that I make. The appellant, appellee attorney, has to concede, or did concede, that the analog offered by Chief Justice Steele of the European civil system, which I found interesting, didn't know that, would be acceptable at a restitution hearing. Pratt teaches us otherwise. Due process does apply at a restitution hearing. The prosecution argues that there is some type of launching pad necessary for the constitutional right of confrontation or due process to kick in that the testimony must be suspect and pass that litmus test before then a judge considers the implications of confrontation. That's not the law. Thirdly, interestingly, in talking about an abuse of discretion standard, the $200 amount was accepted at face value without any supporting documentation because the prosecutor argues that that was reasonable. $30 for a pair of sneakers was disallowed. I think that's an understatement. $30 to get a pair of sneakers nowadays, is, if anything, it's too low. There is no rational basis in the record why the $30 sneakers was disallowed, the $200 cash was accepted. Lastly, and this addresses Chief Justice Steele's questions to the prosecutor and to me, we are here not because of the marijuana issue, or I'm here. This is a pro bono, doing it for principle only. Marijuana issue I threw in, I never would have been here if it hadn't been for the more pertinent issue of the threats. Routinely, as you know, having done criminal trials at the trial level, anytime a witness has consumed alcohol or consumed drugs without there being any scientific documentation, things in common knowledge, Brinkley versus State, are allowed in front of the jury. And routinely, were you drinking alcohol that night without having to have a foundation as to how much and what effect it would have? And I submit here that it was a question of weight, not admissibility, with regard to the drug issue. And even though I couldn't back it up with saying This person consumed this much, therefore his cognition was reflects in his cognition. Common sense would allow the judge to consider that. That's all I have to offer.
Thank you very much, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.